everything comes from God. We are created in God's image. And the Bible says that is our very starting identity. That we as humans all carry part of God. I mean, not a part of His essence, but a part of His personality, a part of His creative nature. We are created to reflect that. So we should expect that every single person out in the world, in some sort of way, broken, messed up, you know, in the middle of a big pile of trash that is what they've created, there should be something that's true about God in there. Not only that, God says that we're not only created in His image, that we're created with this innate ability to at least have a chance to know Him at some level. Romans 1:19 through 20, in part, says, "What may be known about God is plain to everyone, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and His divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made." That means that the most evil of persons is going to have some glimmer of understanding of something that's true. And so what we're doing here is that we're trying to go out and sort through everything, find what's true, and pull it out. So we have The Matrix, we have Braveheart, we have Forrest Gump, we have The Truman Show, all of these things that have a glimmer of truth that we need to use. We're using as a starting point to communicate the gospel. You know, I'm not going to like say somebody you need to watch The Matrix and that's all you ever need to know about God. But you can talk about The Matrix and use it as a starting point. That is exactly what God does with us, right? I mean, if you think about it, God doesn't speak human languages, right? I mean, you don't think up in heaven He happens to speak Greek or Aramaic or Hebrew. But He wrote the Bible in those languages. So everything He said to us, whether He says it directly to our hearts, He says it through the body communicating to us, or He's written it down in the Bible, God is communicating to us on our level, in our way of communicating, and He's translating. I mean, He goes, you go have a profound spiritual experience up on the mountain, say, or you go even to Gates Pass, or wherever it is, and you encounter something bigger than yourself. God is saying, this is Me. This is something I want you to see. Jesus did the same thing when He was here on earth. Even though Jesus was a man, He still used imagery. I mean, it's the equivalent of taking movies out of culture. He said, here's something common you know about. Here's a king or a slave or a farmer or something like this. I want to tell you this story. And then I want to say, God is like that. And so when we're looking at movies or we're looking at popular music or TV, it's all an opportunity to be a parable, to communicate. Sorry. So I've mentioned the idea of translating. I think that's something that's important as you go through this. You have to think that when you're going out and you're talking to someone, they're not going to have the same ideas as you. They're not going to have the same culture necessarily as you. I mean, we're all part of this big American culture, but it has all these different facets. And so the way you dress, the way you speak, the mannerisms that you use are all things that have to be translated. We don't expect, when a missionary goes off to some foreign land, we don't expect that all the people of that land to learn English, right? I mean, the missionary learns the foreign language and does the translating. Emily's parents are part of Wycliffe, and that's all they do. Is they go, they find some tribe of 400 people, but they have a different language. And so people dedicate their entire lives to translating the Bible for those 400 people. That's when we think of being missional, we have to be thinking in terms of that we are going out and we are making the step, we are making the stretch so that somebody else can understand. Now, when we translate, sometimes people are so worried about trying to get acceptance and trying to get understanding that they miss the point of the gospel. They fluff it up, they take all the key points out. And that's what I'm not talking about. In translating, what we have to do is we have to take what is true, the old truths that God has been saying to us throughout time, and we have to form them in a new way that communicates to this person. But if everybody is created in the image of God, and if everybody has some understanding of God, we have to confront the question of who are we to say that we're right? I mean, really, I mean, we're just another group of people who say that we have the truth. And if we say that we're right, then we're not. We're not right. I mean, there's nothing that says that we as Christians are the ones who have the lock on truth. I mean, we have all kinds of cultural things that we've added into the truth. We've said, you know, this is the way you're supposed to dress. This is the songs you're supposed to sing. These are, you know, you're not supposed to drink. You're not supposed to smoke, you know, or whatever those things we've added to the gospel. We're not right. What's right is God, and God offers the Bible to tell us. So when we read the Bible, we're looking at the heart of the gospel. We're reading what the few little things that we have to know about God are there. Everything else is just a guess. So, just open it up. What does the Bible say about God? Just throw stuff out. There's a lot, but what? All powerful. He's love. He's everywhere. Sent his son to save us. Knows everything. Has integrity. I like that. Has a plan. Okay. Compassionate, created the universe. Cool. Yeah. All right. What does the Bible say about us? Sinful. Yes. We're like sheep, okay? Stupid, right? Okay. What does the Bible say? What? Excuse me? What? Yes, that's cool. Created in His image. So what does the Bible say about how do we fix the problem of sin? According to the Bible. We don't. Okay, right. Well, God fixes the problem through Jesus, right. That it's entirely centered on Jesus coming to save us. And that we're just responding to that. So Paul says in 1 Corinthians, I think it is, that he came and he didn't offer anything to the Corinthians but Jesus Christ and Him crucified. He didn't have anything that got in the way or anything in addition that was cultural. He just said, "This is who God is. This is who you are, and this is Jesus who came to save us." So, as we move on into Acts 17, which is where we're going to be tonight, that's what I want to be thinking about. That if our identity here in the church is that we're missional, and we're going to have to be translating all of these things, and we're going to have to be removing all these cultural premises and cultural preferences, we have to be thinking about the heart of it is God's status, our status, and how we fix it all. Paul was the master of this kind of translation. Okay? He grew up within Jewish society. He was the good boy. All right? Basically, it says that he kept all the laws, he did all the sacrifices, he did everything right. But it was all cultural. When Jesus came and offered truth and offered salvation, Paul didn't accept it. And he went and he persecuted all the Christians. But God comes, changes his life, and then sends him out to the Gentiles. So he's like the Jewish golden boy, but he's got to go out to all the people that the Jews hate and speak the truth to them somehow. You know, I hated you for most of my life. By the way, I love you now. How are you going to communicate that? How are you going to get past all of the ways you dress and the ways you eat to, in order to communicate the gospel to these people? Paul does it in every city. In every city, he preaches in a different way. He preaches the same gospel, but in a different way. So he goes to some cities, and he just gets a job as a tent maker, and he works with people, and he builds relationships. He goes to other cities, and he comes in as a full-time preacher. He comes to some places, and he's a philosopher. He comes to other places, and he's just a very simplistic man from out of town offering a very simplistic gospel. He comes, and he looks at every city, finds out how they think and how to reach them, and then uses it. He comes to Athens in Acts 17, and he knows some things to start about Athens. First of all, he knows that Athens is a dying power. Athens, back when the Greeks were in control of the world, Athens was the center of their culture and basically the center of the world. The most powerful place politically. It was the home of the greatest philosophers and the greatest scientists of Plato, Aristotle, Socrates. I mean, everything was in Athens. The best architecture. Athens was where it was. Now that the Romans are in control, Rome is the political power, and Athens is just kind of living on its old laurels. They have this reputation of being the home of the philosophers, so everybody thinks he's the new Socrates. And nobody is, really. I mean, Luke writes the book of Acts, and he's a doctor. He's a very organized, thoughtful, practical man. And he says, you know, these people, all they ever do is just sit around and jabber about the latest philosophical theories. They never get anything done. They're not really philosophers. They're just talking about somebody else's ideas. And it's just like Luke puts it up as that these people, frankly, just kind of look kind of nonsensical, that they're somebody to laugh at. Paul comes in, though, and says there's somebody to be converted. So Paul, when he gets to Athens, he's on the run. He's been to Thessalonica and he's been to Berea. And both times he's been run out of the city by the Jews, just barely escapes with his life. And essentially, when he goes to Athens, he's just looking for a place to hide out until things cool down. But because he's missional, his whole identity is being a missionary. He says, well, while I'm hiding out, I'm going to be a missionary. I'm going to see if I can't convert some more people. So he goes around, and the first thing he sees, and the last thing he sees, and everything in between, are idols. I mean, there's a historian who says that at this time it was easier to find an idol than it was a man in Athens. I mean, it was just everywhere. And Paul, of course, raised a good Jew. He knows the Ten Commandments. He knows that idols are not supposed to be a good way to worship God, right? Don't make a graven image, is what God says. But he goes there and he studies it all. And he gets involved. It says, verse 16, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. Now, the commentaries I read said that in the Greek, this word distressed kind of has a double meaning. That on one hand, Paul comes in as a Jew who knows the Ten Commandments, and he sees all of this sin happening, and he's angry. He's really incensed that these people are so habitually, in such a large scale, just into idolatry. But the other half of the meaning is that Paul comes in here and he's hurting for the Athenians, that he's distressed for them, because he sees that, well, you want to worship something, and you don't understand. You don't know the truth. And so he's emotionally involved. And I think that's a key to being missional. It's really easy to be in church and to talk about being missional. But if you're not in the lives of the people around you, of your friends and your co-workers, if you're not getting emotionally invested in their sin, you're not going to go out and try to stretch and try to change something in you in order to give them the gospel. You have to be emotionally involved in order to be missional. But, okay, so Paul is getting involved. He's looking at all these idols. The first thing he does in response is he goes to the church. Verse 17. He reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. Now, going to the synagogue was Paul's regular habit. He would come to any church, and that was the one thing that was consistent. He would come, and he would go to the synagogue and offer the gospel. Because when Paul is going out through the Roman world, Christianity is not well spread through all areas. And there are a lot of people there who really genuinely love God. They're either Jews, born Jews, or non-Jews who had heard about God of the Old Testament and really loved Him and wanted to worship Him. So there's all these people who honestly love God. They're Christians, but they don't know anything about Christ. So he goes and he offers the gospel. He says that Jesus is the confirmation and the fulfillment of all of these Old Testament prophecies you've been waiting for. And immediately he gets converts. He immediately gets allies who will help him, who say, yeah, this is what I'm waiting for. This is great. But after going to the synagogue, he doesn't stop in the church, which I think is great. He goes out to the marketplace, and he starts talking with people. Now, that's the culturally appropriate thing. I mean, yet nowadays, if you see somebody in the supermarket who's trying to talk to a bunch of people about Jesus, he's probably a nut, right? Or you see the guys down at U of A at Speaker's Corner, right? They are definitely, well, there are some people who go who really mean well, but most of them are real nut jobs. But in this Greek culture, that was the appropriate place you went. See, the marketplace, there would be a lot of people there. They're buying and selling things. There's a lot of people milling about. It's the culturally appropriate place where you, if you have an idea and you want to talk to people or you want to make an announcement, you go to the marketplace and you speak there. So there are places in our culture where you can go there. You can invite somebody over to your house. You can go to a book club. You can go to a coffee shop. Whatever it is, he's finding an appropriate place to start pushing the gospel out to everybody out on the street. Now, when Paul does this and he starts talking about his philosophy, immediately, of course, people start to argue with him. They don't agree with everything. The Acts records in specific two groups. One was the Epicureans and one was the Stoics. And these are great philosopher groups from Athens. You know, they all think that they know what's going on. The Epicureans are basically rationalists. They believe that there is no God, or at least if there is, he's not really involved. That everything happens by chance. There's no life after death, and there's no spiritual realm, really. So when Paul starts saying stuff about that there is a God, that he comes and he's actually doing things in the world, and that there's such a thing as a heaven and hell, they immediately get involved because he's coming up against their philosophy. With the Stoics, they're the opposite of the Epicureans. They believe that everything is God. It's like the force. It's pantheistic. I'm God, you're God, the chair is God, the world is God, everything is God. Everything happens by fate. I'm not really responsible for what's going on. They do believe that there's a resurrection, but it's only a spiritual resurrection, not a bodily one. So Paul starts talking about Jesus being raised from the dead, and they get interested. So he goes and he's speaking in the marketplace with these people. He's connecting with them in the culturally appropriate place. But he's connecting politely, which is cool. I mean, as Christians, we often tend to browbeat people. Well, some of us do. I know you're better than that. But as Christians, we browbeat people, but Paul doesn't do this. I mean, even though the Epicureans and the Stoics totally disagree with him, the Epicureans say that he's a babbler, he's just created his own religion, and he's just talking nonsense. The Stoics say that he's introducing some foreign god, and we don't like foreign gods in Athens. But they both respect him. And they invite him to the Areopagus, which is basically their philosopher convention, it sounds like. I mean, you got a whole city that does nothing but talk. This is the place where they talk. They all get together to talk about the latest ideas. Paul gets center stage because he has presented this in a way that they don't agree with him, but they respect him intellectually. He's speaking within their culture. He's not speaking something that's foreign to them. It's something that's intriguing to them. I love Paul's introduction here because it is absolutely opposite of anything that I would do or I've ever heard done. Verse 22. Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship and even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. Now what you worship is something unknown I'm going to proclaim to you. It's the total reversal of what you would normally see. I mean, the defining characteristic of Athens is that they're full of idolatry. And so normally what you would see is somebody coming and saying, you guys are all sinners and you need to repent. Paul instead says, you know what? You're very religious. That's a good thing. It's a starting point. It's not the end, but it's a starting point. And that's really good. And so he compliments them, and then he starts drawing in things he knows about their history and their culture. Because it's not just a matter of he's respectful. He's not just thoughtful of their cultural forms. He's studied them, and he knows them in detail. See, the altar to the unknown God came about 300 or 400 years before Paul. There was a plague in Athens. Okay, everybody's just dropping left and right. And they can't figure out which of their gods is mad. I mean, they've sacrificed to Athena and to Zeus and everybody else that they've ever heard of. Nobody seems to be able to stop the plague. So they're desperate. And they call in a prophet called Epimedes from, was it Crete? And they say, you know, we got to figure out what's going on here. What are we going to do? Epimedes says, don't worry, I got a solution here. I want you to take a bunch of sheep, and I'll set them loose. And the God who is causing this plague will drive all the sheep to his temple. And when they stop there, you'll have a big sacrifice to that God and appease the God in the plague. Well, it doesn't work that way. You see, they set loose this whole herd of sheep. And instead of going one place, they scatter everywhere. They're like dying. They're laying down in the middle of the street, going everywhere in the city. And so they're like, well, there must be some god that we don't have a temple to that's mad at us. So they sacrifice all the sheep to this unknown god. And for hundreds of years afterwards, they're setting up this temple to the star-dot-star god, the god we don't know. Okay? Yeah, somebody got that. I didn't know if anybody would get that joke. Good for you, John. Anyway. So they've got all these unassigned idols. And Paul says, okay, you guys have been worshiping this unknown God for a long time. I'm going to take it. He's stealing culture. He's like saying, this is yours, this is sin, not anymore. It's mine. It belongs to my God. I'm going to tell you about this God, and he's entirely different than any of the other gods you've mentioned before, or that you've known before. Verse 24, he starts to make the separation. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands. He is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. So Paul starts with a compliment. He says, you're very religious. I really respect that. And then goes immediately off that, jumps off into this huge differentiation. Every god you've ever known has a temple. He's got an image, a statue. He's got some sort of a symbol. You offer all kinds of sacrifices to him. And what I'm telling you is that this unknown God you've been trying to worship, he isn't like that. He's entirely different. So if you're going to be missional, you have to start with some sort of connecting point, but then you have to say, this isn't what you always thought. This is different. He goes into detail, starts attacking their philosophies. He says, from one man, he made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. Now this is like flies right in the face of the Epicureans. And he's doing this intentionally. He knows the groups that are in front of him, and he says, okay, Epicureans, you think that there is no God, or that if there is a God, he's not powerful, everything happens by chance. I need to tell you the truth. There is a God, he is powerful, he's in control, and he chose what house you live in. If you move across the city to another house, that's because he told you to. If you move to another city, that's because he told you to. Epicurean philosophy is not the end. The unknown God is different. Then he goes after the Stoics in verse 27. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each of us. So he says to the Stoics, I know your philosophy. I've read your books. You believe that God is everywhere. God is everything. But he's not. God is near you. He wants you to know him. But you're not him. You're going to have to change. You're going to have to pursue him. And don't blame it on fate. God is sitting there right next to you, waiting for you to take a step. So he's challenged both the Epicureans and the Stoics. He's offering truth in a way that they understand. But then he brings it back full circle. He says in verse 28, for in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. So he starts with a compliment, makes a very significant and clear differentiation, and then closes it up with a compliment. He's brought the whole thing full circle. You know who wrote the quote, for in him we live and move and have our being? Epimedes, the guy who created all these temples to the unknown God. He's making all of the connections so that they have some way of remembering this and really paying attention to it. Now, all of this is well and good. Okay? Paul has taken all these steps that have to be as far as being a missionary. He's gotten emotionally involved in things. He's gone to the culturally appropriate places to talk about things. He's talked about them in an intellectually understandable way. He's complimentary to their culture. But, you know, he's an Amway salesman if that's all he does, right? I mean, you can package anything in that box. Unless you go to the end and you expect that the gospel is going to do something. The gospel is going to be spiritually transforming. And we have to offer people the ability or the opportunity to choose. In verse 29, he lays it out. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to all men by raising them from the dead. So there is hellfire and brimstone in Paul's message, but it's at the end. I was thinking about this, and I realized that's what God does. I mean, you start in Genesis, what happens? You start in Eden, in the perfect situation, in the best place that can be. Hellfire and brimstone is in the Bible, but it's all at the end. After you've come to know God, you've come to understand all these things about God, Paul says you have to make a choice. So if we're going to be missional, we have to offer people the ability to choose. We have to put it in front of them and say that there is a clear standard, and it has to be one or the other. That's really scary to me. I mean, it's really easy to build relationships with people and to go out and be nice to them. But to sit somebody down and confront them and say, what you have is not going to save you from hell. That's terrifying. Absolutely. I mean, but that we have to tell them that. Ezekiel has when Ezekiel is called by God, he has this great commission. He has a great commission. Because God says, I'm going to send you to sinners, and I'm going to send you to righteous people, and I'm going to tell you to give them warnings. Now, if you speak to a sinner and he goes on sinning, then that guy will go to hell. He'll die for his own sin. If you speak to a righteous man and he ignores you and starts sinning, that'll be between him and me. But if I tell you to go to somebody, if I tell you to go to a sinner, or I tell you to go to a righteous man, and you don't, and he dies in his sin, he will die for his sin. But I'm going to hold you responsible for the fact that he did. I don't think we're going to lose our salvation for that. But I do believe that God takes it very, very seriously. If we have friends and we say, I don't have the guts to talk to them about the hardcore issues because I'm scared, and they die in their sin, we're held accountable for that. We can't force things to happen, but we have to give them the chance. When Paul gives them the chance, there's three kinds of responses, and we're going to get these same three responses. The first is what you always hope for. It's the immediate change. There were people in the synagogue, and there were people in the Areopagus who heard what Paul said. It immediately clicked. It was that God had been working in their lives, and they said, yes, I believe, I want to become a Christian, I want to do this, and I want to do it now. So that's great. We're going to get those people if we're going to be missional, and we're going to give them the chance. Second group of people is people who aren't sure yet. And you do get a lot of those people. A lot of people who say, what you say is intriguing. I want to hear you again. I want to have a relationship with you. I want to discuss this. But I'm not ready to make a decision at this point yet. Some of those people become Christians in the end. Some of them don't. Paul leaves them with the space to say, okay, you can talk about it. Of course, there's also the people who absolutely reject Paul, who just say that he's an idiot and a fool. And we're going to get that too. That's the risk. I mean, that's what I always am afraid of, is somebody thinking I'm an idiot and a fool. But that's only one out of three. So, what does it mean being missional in today's world? I have a friend at the apartment complex who is huge into Metallica, and especially heavy metal. And I don't know how you guys were raised, but in my house, everything heavy metal was sin, pretty much. You know, Metallica certainly was the symbol of all things evil in music. So I have no knowledge of Metallica. I had no desire to know Metallica. But he's really big into it. And I wanted to be with him and be able to connect with him at some level. So I'm over at his apartment, and he's got a DVD from Blockbuster of a live show of Metallica. And he puts it on, and it's like 9:30 at night. Cranks it all the way up, of course, you know, and I'm like, Lord, please don't let the cops get called. But he does it. We're like, you know, 45 minutes to an hour of listening to this guy go, you know, and I was effing thinking about this effing song. Y'all effing want to hear it? And it's, okay, I'll effing play it for you. And they go off and play something that I can't understand and just doesn't make any sense to me. But I'm like, okay. So we get to the end, he shuts it off. Cops don't get called, which is nice. And I ask him, okay, I don't understand this. I know this is big for you. I know this is important to you, so I want to understand it. But I don't get what you like about this music. And so we get to have a really good conversation. I get to know him a little bit in that. But then I think, you know, if I really want to know this guy, if I really want to be able to connect with him and communicate with him, I got to know his music. So I get my hands on a bunch of Metallica music and some AC/DC and just start listening to it. I'm like, okay, I got to, you know, at least I'll be able to recognize a couple of the songs. So, you know, that's something at least. And I found a couple of songs that were not too bad, so I listened some more. And I don't know. Now I'm a huge Metallica fan. I mean, it's all I listen to, practically. I got this playlist of stuff I listen to at work. I used to listen to country all the time. The guys walk by, and they're like, is that Inner Sandman? Yeah. I'm like, my playlist is like 60% Metallica. It's got a little bit of U2 and AC/DC and Queen all mixed in. So, but anyway, what I found was that the guys of Metallica are created in God's image. And the way they play music is created in God's image. They have some understanding of things. Now, I'm not going to say that you need to listen to Metallica. You're not going to get saved by listening to Metallica. But they do have a starting point for the gospel. And I would say, you should be where your friends are. The people God has put in your life, what are they listening to? What movies are they watching? What are the things that you can do where you can understand them? I mean, I saw my friend recently, and he has on this shirt that says TNT, which I never understood before. But now I knew that TNT was a song by AC/DC. I can even hum the melody. I mean, I know that song. And what? Yes. Actually, there's AC/DC is not as good as Metallica. But anyway, so I look, and sure enough, it says the ultimate AC/DC tribute in little letters. And it felt really good to think it used to be that I was just his friend. You know, he liked hanging with me, I liked hanging with him. But now there's some commonality. I understand at a certain level. I don't understand everything because he says I shouldn't have listened to Metallica, I should have listened to Megadeth instead. So, that's the next project. But it's an opportunity to be missional. At least now I can start to quote stuff. And, yeah, I want to bring it into worship stuff, frankly. Not their lyrics. Anyway, but they have some great songs. If anybody knows the song Hunger that they released with Megadeth, I can't understand any of the lyrics except for the chorus, but the chorus is great. So I'm hoping that the verse is something we can use for worship. And, like, take Metallica, bring it into the church and say, this used to be yours, it used to be centered on sin. I steal it. It now belongs to God. It's being used for God. So I want to close with reading a letter in the context of expecting that people are in the process of spiritual transformation. This guy, letter was written, it's a handwritten letter that I found out on the web, downloaded, written about 3 weeks ago by a guy who's in alcohol rehab. He says, James here, alive, and getting well. Where do I start? Recovery is the most difficult and challenging thing I've ever attempted, along with parenting. Also the most grounding and gratifying gift I've ever received, along with parenting. I've so much to say. I feel I've been away a lifetime, in the way I have. My music and lyrics have always been a therapy for me. Without this God-given gift, I don't know where I'd be. And now I truly feel the impact and connection it's made with others. Struggle to struggle, pain to pain, human to human, not idol to fan, fan to idol. Clarity has put me in a humble and serene place to receive this connection in return and to feel it helping heal me. Every breath I take becomes deeper and more confident of myself without my crutches. The lies I've filled my body and soul with aren't needed anymore. They're not welcome. I choose to live and not just exist. I miss you all so much. And I am awaiting the time this deeper connection I feel to you will be in person. Love and respect, James. That is James Hetfield, who is lead singer of Metallica, wrote a lot of their songs. So, is there somebody missional in his life? He's written songs about that, about I didn't know that history, but about the emptiness of preachers that he's known. What if there's somebody missional in his life? Somebody who knows his music, knows his life, loves him for what he is, respects him, and then says, look, you're feeling that deeper connection. You're abandoning the old lives, and you feel like you're coming alive. After being dead, let me tell you where the solution is, where the life is. I don't know. But that's what missional is. That's what we at the Village are all about, is finding those people, connecting to them, and offering them the truth where they can at least make the choice. We're going to head back to worship.